Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. And this time, it's my enormous pleasure to talk to Ken Sloan, Deputy Vice Chancellor and Senior Vice President, Enterprise and Governance at Monash University in Australia. As is customary, we start by exploring Ken's varied career journey, from an initial brush with accountancy before a typically varied career at the University of Warwick, including an overlap with me at the government-inspired National Academy for Gifted and Talented Youth, before becoming Deputy Registrar. Ken then had a brief stint in the private sector before returning to Warwick as Registrar and COO, and then ending up at Monash. Inevitably, we discuss the distinctive nature of the Warwick experience and the key question asked of all ambitious administrators there: do they have a Registrar's baton in their knapsack? With NAGTI, Ken reflects on the consequences of the tension between short-term government policy initiatives and longer-term strategic objectives of a university, before commenting on the very different perspective of working for a private sector company aiming to deliver a public good ethos and what seemed to be a rather unusual recruitment process. The move to Monash was one Ken felt prepared for, and noted the importance of not assuming the same words in the same language have the same meaning. The initial experience as Deputy Vice-Chancellor felt quite different to being a Registrar. Ken had a lot to learn, including about the need to influence with limited resources to direct, together with the challenges of coping with different policy streams emerging from state and federal government, not to mention the impact of closed borders on operations under COVID. Monash has developed plans for recovery and learned a great deal from the pandemic, from focusing on student retention, partnerships, relationships with business, and moving more rapidly to e-assessment and different working patterns. Ken's just been announced as the next Vice-Chancellor of Harper Adams University back in the UK, and he's now looking forward to supporting the university's strong student focus and concentrating on food, sustainability and technology innovation there, noting that the impact of Brexit on agriculture entails a very different approach, but also new areas of collaboration. In conclusion, Ken reflects on what is still an unusual journey in the UK from administrator to vice chancellor. I do hope you enjoy it. Welcome, everyone, to the latest edition of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. And this time, it's my great pleasure to be talking to Ken Sloan. Ken is Deputy Vice Chancellor and Senior Vice President, Governance and Enterprise at Monash University in Australia. Welcome, Ken. Great to see you again.
Great to see you, Paul, and great to be able to have a conversation with you.
Excellent. Well, listen, we go back quite a long way, but I think what I really like to hear from you first off is a bit about your career trajectory, because you've been down a few highways and byways before ending up in your current position. You know, having worked in higher education for most of that time, but how did you end up in, you know, Monash?
So, a couple of things. You will know that I graduated in English language and literature and then went on to be an accountant. So therefore, my very first move was always never going to be quite a straight line. Started life at KPMG, moved to Warwick in the student recruitment area, and started what many of us have done over the years, which is a broad generalist management leadership role over a number of years. So at Warwick, went on from student recruitment, went to work in the Vice Chancellor's office and was the executive officer to the Vice Chancellor at the time, then moved into the graduate school planning back into student recruitment. You and I had an overlap in that you were the founding director for the National Academy for Gifted and Talented Youth, and then I went over to NAGTI to oversee the corporate and the student side, and then came back into Warwick to be the wonderfully titled Director of Campus Affairs, then succeeded you as Deputy Registrar, and then left Warwick to move into Serco, the FTSE 100 company, came back to be the Registrar, Chief Operating Officer, and after a period of doing that, left initially to come straight to Australia, but had the opportunity to go to Tsinghua University to be part of the opening of Schwarzman College, and ultimately ended up in Monash as the Deputy Vice Chancellor for Enterprise and more recently Enterprise and Governance.
Fantastic. I mean, it's you know, it's a really interesting journey, and as with so many people, and I've spoken to quite a few people from Warwick, many of whom I was contemporaries with as well. But there is always a sense in which that, you know, wherever it takes you, Warwick is somehow kind of preparing you for that journey, even though you don't necessarily appreciate it at the time. Is that the way you see it now?
Well, I think certain things make sense at a certain point in your career that you didn't know at the time. So when you are asked a question, which all of us were asked in some way, shape or form, which was roughly, do you have a registrar's baton in your knapsack? And it happens to be the first entry level job you've applied for at a university, you know that you are being tested out on how far and how fast you intend to work. The other thing I think is I was one of the rare people at Warwick that actually got the job I applied for, because the other thing that used to happen a lot was people were applied for a job in the general administrative officer category or assistant registrar or senior assistant registrar, and then the job they were offered was not necessarily the one that they applied for. That whole issue of being able to get a very broad, multifaceted approach to university management, university leadership, the interface with academics, the interface with the outside world. I think anyone who's been through that Warwick experience, that's what they've experienced. That's been an integral part. And I think that's probably the reason why so many people have gone on to varied and interesting places, because it generally prepares you for that.
No, I think that's absolutely right. The National Academy for Gifted and Talented Youth, which you mentioned there, was a really interesting diversion for me as well as for you. And I think that what struck me about that at the time, I found it a really interesting project, was it was the first time I'd ever actually been involved with something which appeared to be, well, was explicitly delivering a government policy commitment, right, on behalf of the government. And trying to do it in a way which met those broad policy objectives, but in a way where there was actually quite a lot of freedom to do it as you wanted. And obviously I started that off and then handed it over to others, including yourself, to actually do it properly. But what's your reflection on that as a project? Because is it still going in some form? Or was it one of those things that just ended up being something that government changed its mind about in the end?
I think it was one of those things that government changed its mind about. It started, as you know, with a view that it had a view that it wanted to find the top 5% of people aged in the secondary school age group. And then suddenly, because of the way the admissions process worked, we found ourselves with not 20,000 students, but we found ourselves with something like 150,000. So they thought, well, now what we need to do is think about how to provide something for the whole lot. So they, if you remember, what they did was they moved away from having an academy to thinking of a general register of provision for the gifted. And then a couple of years later, the policy changed again and it was no longer there. And I think you're right. There's a really interesting difference between when you develop an intervention within the university sector, because you're doing it in the context of a long-term organization that's multi-generational. Even if the leadership changes, the overall direction is broadly consistent in how it goes forward. And yet with government policy, you are dealing with the policy of the day, the people of the day, their priorities, their reading of what society wants at that moment in time. So it was a very different experience for all of us, I think. And receiving that letter to say that they were not continuing with it after all the work that had gone in came as a bit of a surprise for everyone involved.
Yeah, it's very frustrating. But, you know, yet another valuable learning experience for us all. Tell me about the time in the private sector then, because that was, you know, I remember thinking that's a bold move and thinking how interesting. And then, you know, actually being, you know, quite intrigued by what you were actually doing in that role and indeed how they recruited you, because it was just a very different process all round. So looking back on that time, do you feel it as a valuable opportunity for you?
I think it was probably one of the most valuable things that I did, because Firstly, what it showed me was that there was a company that had a genuine interest in the public good, even though it started from a different perspective. It was a profit-making company, and it often, like companies like that, is often criticized for being involved in profit-making in the delivery of public services. But it wasn't full of private sector people who'd all come through private sector lives. It was full of people in the public sector who had actually been given an opportunity to look at the same issue through a different lens. The thing that was interesting was, as you say, the way I was recruited, it wasn't by an advert. It was by a phone call, via a phone call, followed by a lunch, followed by a dinner, followed by a series of meetings, followed by a job offer, without not necessarily fully knowing it was a recruitment process at the time. And then the other aspect of it was the freedom to create a view within the company as to whether working with the university sector was a good thing to do. So this was an exploratory role. It was to talk to people in the sector, leaders in the sector, vice chancellors, COOs, registrars, to see, was there an appetite to think about the way in which the either delivery of education or delivery of services could be done in a different way. And obviously this was coming on the back of the GFC, so there were pressures on the public purse. But the reality of it was that there was a difference of size between the two sectors. They were used to working with large contracts over long periods of time. So they very typically would have hundreds of millions of pounds worth of contracts, or they would have a contract which was about 15 years long. Talking to the sector, the notion of talking to a registrar or a vice chancellor about giving these services or these things to someone to look after and do it for that length of time is just completely and utterly inconceivable. It just wasn't there. The thing that really attracted me though when I was inside was that, for all of the criticism that there often is about organizations, and I know this particular organization has been very front and center in COVID in the UK, there really was a commitment to thinking about the end user and how to deliver the best thing for the end user, and also exactly the same type of outcomes that the university would be looking at, but just from a starting point which was different. And so what it did for me was it taught me that I might have been shown like 7 or 8 ways of doing something, but there were actually 10, 15, 20, 25, and really encouraged me to think, don't just assume that the natural response you've got is the right response. There's multiple responses. And the only other thing it taught me about the sector was sometimes how difficult it is to be an outsider to this sector. So I remember going and having conversations with people, and one day I was an integral part of the sector, an integral part of like a management team, leadership team, and then suddenly I was the other, and being spoken to as I was the other, and et cetera. And it made me realize that sometimes if the sector's trying to build relationships, it needs to have a bit more empathy with the other side of the table and vice versa. I absolutely no regret about doing it.
I thought it was a really, really interesting step. And then let's fast forward to Australia then, right? Because you're at Monash, you've been there for a few years as Deputy Vice Chancellor, and you know, very senior role, you know, with enterprise and now more recently governance hat on. Going to Australia, I mean, it's a very different, you know, superficially the higher education system looks similar to the UK, but actually it's a very different world in terms of, you know, scale and history and traditions and operating approach. So didn't you feel like another outsider there coming in? I mean, you know, it must have been a really tough transition, or did you just breeze in?
I had the advantage of having some prior warning about the differences, which helped me to work that out, which was really, really helpful. The thing that became very clear, and this is what had been said to me, which was, don't think that the same words and the same language have the same meaning. And, don't assume that the toolkit you've got that you can use in one particular part of the world in that sector is necessarily going to work in another part of the world. But the reality of it is the two jobs couldn't have been more different, because the job, as you know, of a registrar, COO, whatever variation of that is, you have significant access to resource and people. You are directly connected to the strategic development, strategic delivery of what happens in the university. And you have many, many levers to pull. This time I was going into a job where I knew I probably have the smallest budget of the senior team, the smallest group of staff to work with, some very high expectations over what it was going to deliver within the institution, and just a completely different mode of working was required. So instead of being able to devise and deploy how I use my own resources in whatever way and influence others, it was all about influence. It was about creating a strategic recognition of a need for a particular type of either outcome or behavior or change, and taking a large population of people with me. And that's the other thing that hits you when you go. Warwick these days is a large university in the context of the UK. It's in the larger end of the sector. But then when you go to Monash and it's 87,000 students and it's close to 16,000 headcount of staff, it's an order of magnitude which is completely and utterly different. The thing that's fascinating, though, is that the same issue applies, which is people in institutions in the UK, people in institutions in Australia, they are aligned to having a positive impact on students, graduates. They want to undertake the highest quality research. They want to translate those research outcomes to the benefit of society. And that is what unites them. So the funding model may be different. The staffing model may be different. The way in which the sector is resourced internally and externally is fundamentally different. I remember being at my first meeting of a management team and someone mentioned the fact that if international students became under pressure, then we would have to really think about how we were going to cross-subsidise research. I nearly leaned across the table and said, shush, you're not supposed to tell anyone that you cross-subsidise research. Because in the UK, that was always the thing that you never talked about. Whereas in Australia, it's a very clear strategic intent, which is that you grow the total funding base of the university. It enables you to deliver the best quality education and also invest in research. And it's very open, it's very transparent.
Yeah. So Australian universities have come through, or faced the challenges of COVID in the same way as those in the UK have. Mm. The policy environment, though, has placed additional challenges. I mean, we've had our own challenges in the UK, but, you've got challenges around international students and the attitude in particular of the government towards China, but also challenges around free speech as well, and that kind of thing. So how does it feel? Do you feel under pressure? Do you feel that government is interfering? Is it central government or is it state government? Because I always had the impression that the state was much more supportive of universities than central government necessarily was in Australia. How does that play out?
I think the reality of it is, and I'm sure it was the case, that everyone's under pressure. So government at all levels is under pressure, and so are the universities. I think that nobody is wanting to appear to be overtly making life difficult for the sector in the same way that the sector doesn't think it's making life difficult for government either. The reality of it is a significant amount of research funding and contribution to education funding comes from the federal government. It doesn't come from the state. The state tends to put funding in behind things which create jobs locally or other infrastructure locally. I think what happened was a tsunami of things which, if someone was generous, would say that this is the classic thing that happens when you have a sector like universities feeding out to multiple government departments, and they all come up with ideas at the same time and they throw them in. A bit like departments and faculties often say to the centre of the university, if you'd only join yourselves together and think about it, you wouldn't do this. But these were pretty fundamental, as you say. There was a question about the freedom of expression, which is now translated into a legal definition of freedom of speech and freedom of expression. There was the whole issue around foreign interference, which had been going on for some time. But then suddenly we have the Foreign Relations Act, and the Foreign Relations Act means that every university has to give details of every single agreement they have with any organization which could be connected to either government or other in any other country. And importantly, gives the foreign minister the ability to cancel those agreements. So without reason. There's no reason to be given. And so we're at the early stages of that. All universities have had to submit those agreements and put them in. If I have a look at the UK compared to Australia, as far as I understand it, the UK universities were able and eligible for the furlough scheme. The equivalent scheme within Australia was the JobKeeper scheme, and universities were not allowed to benefit from that. So there was no financial subsidy for towards the cost of salaries in that regard. But the big fundamental thing was the fact that the borders were closed, and they are still closed. So the universities found that the international students they had in the country, they were able to teach out in country, but everyone else was online and was online in whatever country they were in at the time. If you add up all of these dimensions together, they create a really difficult leadership challenge for most universities. At Monash, we did two things. One, obviously, we set up all the infrastructure to manage the crisis, and the Vice Chancellor and the COO did a fantastic job, continue to do a fantastic job leading on that with the rest of the team. But we also started overtly to look at recovery. So at the same time as running the crisis side, we also started to look at the recovery side, not just in terms of how we were going to get to the best outcome in the situation that we're in, but also where were we going to get alternative revenues if they came under significant push. But if you the federal government put in an injection of research funding in last year to help, because they did recognize that there was a loss of income on the international side, therefore that was going to be a loss of capacity, but it was only for one year's amount over that could be spread over 2 years. But it's a really challenging time. The borders are still closed. The country still doesn't know when those borders will open. And other parts of the world are starting to look like they're coming back to life, and it's getting back to business as usual. So I think the advantage for these institutions is their scale, but then they have to grow back to the scale that they've got there. But no, it's been a really, really challenging time.
Yeah. And on that international student recruitment point, I mean, I assume, you know, within a relatively short period, the borders will reopen, right? I mean, are you confident about being able to attract those numbers back, or do you think it will take time to build back up? Because that is a critical income stream as well, isn't it?
Yeah, so if you think about it, we've had, and go back to March 2020 when the COVID matter really hit Australia. In most universities, the students have been on campus for a day, and then they were suddenly off campus, or, well, they were on campus but online. But in Australian universities, a lot of students are living in other settings anyway. So we're now in a position where we're in the second academic year, well into the second academic year, where students who didn't get into the country are not in the country, and also the ones that are here have had to think about, because when we had the long lockdowns, they didn't have access to part-time work and other things. The international students didn't have access to financial support and other things. So it created a significant depression of income in the institutions. So it's not just about the recovery of numbers, it's the recovery of income. As you know, multi-year students, it compounds itself through the plan. So you take a reduction in year one, that flows through. You take another reduction in year two, that flows through. So it is going to take a number of years to get back. And at the same time, that none of us can say with certainty how people are going to see the world in the medium term with regard to just getting back to traveling and being confident about traveling, etc. So, yeah, really, really difficult time, and it's going to take time to recover. That said, I think the sector's done really well. The leadership of institutions has done it really, really well with the challenge. But no one's in any doubt that it's a tough time ahead.
So thinking about that recovery then that you described earlier, as you look forward and see Monash coming out of this hopefully successfully, what are the green shoots for you at the moment? What are the things that you're going to hold on to. I mean, because we've all had to establish different ways of working during this. I mean, are there things coming out of that that you're going to think, well, our operating model is going to be a bit different in future and, you know, in parts of the university? Or are there other things that are going to be different, do you think?
Well, if you have a look at the Cobain data that's used in terms of efficiency, Monash is already one of the most efficient in terms of utilization of resources. So a key part of that is going to be how you get more revenue on the back of the resources you've already got. It's been great to see the appetite and attitude of people across the university to step in and do things differently and also adopt a pace of change, which frankly, most universities wouldn't have been able to achieve prior to this particular point. The one thing that Monash has got is the benefit of being a multinational university, and obviously Nottingham's in a similar position, which means if you've got a crisis that's affecting the whole world, then obviously it can hit you in all directions. But if you have got different places, you can start to develop new ways of delivering education. You can recruit people in different ways. You can think about the connections between the different environments. We've obviously been looking, like everyone else, at the way in which we can support business and other organizations in their own recovery. So how do we adapt our education in that regard? And also the other aspect of it is that we've had to really think about the way in which we not just recruit students, but we retain them and retain their sense of value in what they're getting, not just at the university, but what's going to happen next. So really used it as an opportunity to enhance relationships with employers and others. But it's been a time for different ways of looking at what we do. As Monash had already started to move most of its assessment of students into e-assessment, and we've expanded that significantly over this period of time. But we will face the same that all universities has, which is that the staff, it's the same staff doing it, whether you're an academic staff, member of staff who's teaching or undertaking research, or a professional member of staff who's supporting the activity of the university. There's only a finite amount of capacity. So eventually you've got to acknowledge, you've got to also give some time for people to refresh. The other thing that we've, like everyone will have noticed, is that our use of space is different. We have taken the decision that we have allowed people whose jobs allow it to have a mixed mode between working on site and working off site, and we would expect that to continue. That then enables us to think about appropriate use of space and what that means for the future of the capital plan and a whole raft of different things. But it has been a time where people have really stepped up, and they've stepped up for the institution, they've stepped up for the sector. And I hope that, you know, not just at Monash, but any university, that if that ethos is what's been developed, it can be continued into the future as well.
I think that's a really good point. Yeah, I mean, certainly all the experience I've heard of from other universities has been exactly that. You know, people have come together like never before. There are challenging times ahead, but as you say, you know, we've got the ingredients and the intelligence to make that future work for us, building on what we've learned. But you're leaving all of this behind shortly, aren't you? So you're returning to the UK. In the not too distant future, where you're going to be vice chancellor, chief executive of an organization slightly smaller than Monash, but nevertheless perfectly formed, and the you know, beautiful countryside it's in Shropshire, isn't it, Harper Adams, isn't it? I have been there. It is beautiful. A really lovely campus. But this, you know, a sudden enthusiasm for farming and agriculture is not anything that I'd ever associated with you, Ken. So tell me, what's your transition plan here?
So as I said to you before we started talking, Paul, that I've had some connection to that agenda at Monash, because we've got a big focus on sustainability across a number of different areas. In my area, I took oversight of our food innovation area some time ago, and also was very actively involved quite early on in not the pre-farm gate approach to farming, but actually what you can do with technology and data and satellites, a whole raft of things. We've got researchers all over the university, so I've been working very closely with them. So the the thing that's really appealing about Harper Adams and also excites me about this particular job is two things. One, it does deliver an outstanding experience to its students. Its reputation for doing so is really outstanding, and that's a great basis on which to continue. The academic staff and the professional staff are really motivated to make a difference in the environments and the sectors with which they work. So genuine, real examples of innovation being pushed across the research agenda and the education agenda. But if you think about the impact of Brexit on the UK, you think about the agricultural sector, it's going through a massive transformation in the UK from one which has been predominantly focused on almost a grant approach to funding, to one which says that if communities and landowners want to generate resources, they're going to have to make it work in a way which has a positive impact on the planet. So genuine commitment to sustainable food, sustainable farming, also that whole notion of how technology can be applied across a range of different areas. So not just in the food, farming, agriculture and related, but also how the same technology can then be applied to other sectors and other areas. So there's real scope for building collaborations, not just in the sectors of interest, but actually much broader and more interested in that. So, and I think a number of people will have gone through the COVID experience and realized that actually the opportunity to make a positive difference to an organization, with an organization, but through that organization to real people and real issues that are affecting the planet, not just in the UK, but in other parts of the world, is a genuine motivator. Mm. And I was really, really taken just by the enthusiasm and warmth of the staff, students, alumni, governors, etc. I'm really looking forward to joining and getting on with the job.
Great. Well, I mean, as I say, my one visit there was super, and I really enjoyed it. And I thought, what a fabulous university. Just on the going back to the where we started on the career trajectory. I mean, one of those things that is often said in UK higher education, you know, there are very, very few examples of individuals who've done what you do, which is go from essentially, you know, a senior administrator, registrar, to ultimately vice chancellor, which is what you've done. A few people have done it, including the current VC at Harper Adams, who's gone down that route. So what's your thinking on that now, having had the different perspective, particularly in Australia? I mean, is it such a big issue, or is it just one of those kind of throwbacks to the past that people get unnecessarily hung up on?
I look at it from the perspective of saying it matters more about the institution's future than it does about its past. So everyone has to be respectful to the past of the institution that they've got. It comes down to the skills that are needed to enable that institution to do the job that is that it's trying to achieve. And I think it is the case that there will always be environments where the head of the institution, the vice chancellor, is a researcher, should be a researcher, is a leader of researchers. And that will continue to be the case in many, many environments across the, not only in the UK and in different parts of the world. I think that governing bodies are opening their minds to that question, though, which is, what is the capability for this institution, these students, these graduates, to enable them to have the biggest impact that they can have? And when you've got an institution like Harper, which is very much focused on having a material effect on a sector, communities, international relations in those areas, I think it does enable a broader perspective to be taken. And there are some institutions who have done that and shown that. There are people out there who do research which say that that the best institutions are the ones that either have research-led or, you know, et cetera. I think it comes down to what that institution is, what it's for, and what it's trying to do. And I was deeply encouraged by the openness of mind. The other thing in the Monash job is that I do have a direct responsibility for the work that some of our academics are doing. And so I'm not an academic. I don't claim to be an academic, but I do have accountability for the outcomes of a number of academics who are doing research and academic work in different environments. So coming to Monash, and even Monash as a group of eight university, having the openness to put someone with my background into this job, it's great to see a university like Harper's continue to be equally open-minded.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure we all wish you the very best in that new role when you return to the UK. And Ken, it's been terrific talking to you. Thank you so much for your time, and all the very best in the new role.
No, thank you. I look forward to seeing you later this year.
That's all then from University Registrars talking about stuff this time. There'll be plenty more along in due course. And if you can't wait, then please do check out the Registrarism blog on wonky.com, where you'll find lots of higher education, comment and fun and games. Until next time.